all the speakers, and particularly Jock, are very thankful for the number of people that were able to come. We had no idea what to expect this year at all, but I'm just really thankful that Jock and his colleagues at the Rochester Labrie had the courage to go ahead with the conference. So thank you to all of you for making whatever trek you made to be here. It's not a small thing in this day and age. Yeah, so this is a very, I'm glad that anybody came at all to such a vaguely titled workshop. What in the world is he getting at? But really, I've been interested in, you know, certainly as a result of reading a lot of C.S. Lewis and other people as well, but just in my own observations and myself and other people, the role of longings as an indication of who we are and who made us and why we were made. And of course, those longings, we can all think of so many different examples of the ways those longings have been misdirected and are directed towards the wrong things. But nonetheless, very often the longings themselves indicate something very true and real about us and good. This being a conference about identity, sometimes the things we most long for, the deepest things we most long for, are oftentimes very true indications of our identity or what our identity should be in who God is. So instead of a fancy introduction, I'm going to read a couple of passages from two different books, really, The Hobbit, and then something briefly from Chesterton's book, Orthodoxy. And hopefully it'll become clear what sort of thing I'm talking about by the time I'm done reading. Okay, so for those of you who haven't read The Hobbit, if you have, just try to banish any images from the film The Hobbit that you have in your head, and just think back to that time when you read the book. Bears almost no resemblance to the book. We can talk about that later. But Bilbo Baggins is a very, very comfortable, well-to-do hobbit that has never done anything out of the ordinary, and he sort of disapproves of out-of-the-ordinary types of things. He's the last person you'd expect to go on an adventure. But he has ancestors on the Took side of his family that didn't fit the mold, right? And a bunch of these dwarves have come to his house, and they've just sung this very haunting song about their longing for their lost gold and the city under the mountain where they used to live. And then this is his response. As they sang, the hobbit felt the love of beautiful things made by hands and by cunning and by magic moving through him, a fierce and a jealous love, the desire of the hearts of dwarves. Then something tookish woke up inside him. And he wished to go and see the great mountains and hear the pine trees and the waterfalls and explore the caves and wear a sword instead of a walking stick. He looked out of the window. The stars were out in a dark sky above the trees. He thought of the jewels of the dwarves shining in dark caverns. Suddenly in the wood, beyond the water, a flame leapt up, probably somebody lighting a wood fire. And he thought of plundering dragons settling on his quiet hill and kindling it all to flames. He shuddered, and very quickly he was playing Mr. Baggins of Bag End Underhill again. So later on in the story, after he has been dragged off on an adventure, almost in spite of himself, he winds up on this adventure. And at some uncomfortable, inhospitable moment, probably in a mountain pass somewhere, he says this: I am sure the rain's gotten into the dry clothes and into the food bags. Bother burgling and everything to do with it. I wish I was at home in my nice hole by the fire with the kettle just beginning to sing. It was not the last time that he wished that. So that's The Hobbit. Okay, so you probably noticed something already, but I'm just going to read something from Chesterton. It's from very near the beginning of his book on Orthodoxy, and he expresses it as sort of the motivation for writing the book, Orthodoxy, which I highly recommend. Well, this is G.K. Chesterton. I've often had a fancy for writing a romance about an English yachtsman who slightly miscalculated his course and discovered England under the impression that it was a new island in the South Seas. Of course, I forgot to advance my slides. That's Bilbo Baggins' house. Okay. Anyway, so. All right. I always find, however, that I am either too busy or too lazy to write this fine work, so I may as well give it away for the purposes of philosophical illustration. There will probably be a general impression that the man who landed, armed to the teeth and talking by signs, to plant the British flag on that barbaric temple, which turned out to be the pavilion at Brighton, felt rather a fool. I am not here concerned to deny that he looked a fool. But if you imagine that he felt a fool, or at any rate that the sense of folly was his sole or his dominant emotion, then you have not studied with sufficient delicacy the rich romantic nature of the hero of this tale. His mistake was really a most enviable mistake, and he knew it, if he was the man I take him for. What could be more delightful than to have in the same few minutes all the fascinating terrors of going abroad, combined with all the humane security of coming home again? What could be better than to have all the fun of discovering South Africa without the disgusting necessity of landing there? Is Jock in the room? No, he's not. Okay, good, good. So just apologies to anyone who's from South Africa here. What could be more glorious than to brace oneself up to discover New South Wales and then realize with a gush of happy tears that it was really Old South Wales? This, at least, seems to me the main problem for philosophers, and is in a manner the main problem of this book. How can we contrive to be at once astonished at the world and yet at home in it? How can this world give us at once the fascination of a strange town and the comfort and honor of being our own town? So that's G.K. Chesterton. What do these quotes have, what do they imply or suggest about people? And I think they imply that we have two deep desires. On the one hand, there's a desire for adventure and a desire to explore, to experience newness, to be in the presence of something maybe wild and unexpected. And this is what Chesterton called the longing to be astonished in the world. On the other hand, there's a desire to come home and to find security, to be known, to find familiar things, to lay your pack down at the door and to put your feet up by the fire, kind of image, if that's comforting to you, I don't know. To hear your name spoken with recognition. And you can see how these two desires are, they are, at least on the surface, seem to be at odds with each other. To experience both surprise and comfort, adventure and security, newness and sameness, to set out and to come back and have all the emotional richness that comes with both, to meet new people and yet be known by people. These seem to be almost diametrically opposed desires. They seem to be taking us in two completely different directions in life. They represent two different ways of life. And it seems like an unreasonable request to make of life that we could somehow experience both of these things. To satisfy our need for exploration and yet to feel at home. But in reality, I think most of us feel the pull of both in some way or another. And this may look very different for each of you. Somehow we know that there's something good about both. So when we, just as an example, if we have to travel for weeks and weeks on end, or maybe I've spoken to many people who come to Labrie who've grown up in military families, and maybe as a kid, one of their parents, their job required them to move every couple of years, maybe up to half a dozen, 7 or 8 times during their childhood. There can be, but just imagine yourself traveling on the road, going to multiple different places. There's something we call homesickness, a heartache, something where we're actually missing a place where we belong. And there's a rootlessness that many people feel today who've never really had or never really feel like there's a one place that they can call home. There's one sort of center of gravity of a place that they can call their place. There's no one place where people will recognize you, or no one place that will guide you in terms of where should I settle as an adult, because no one place is any better than any of the others that I've been. Nothing has a hold on me, and I don't have a hold on anything. And that's a real feeling of rootlessness, which is painful, I think. A lack of connection to place. And so I think the longing for home, this longing that I'm describing here, is actually a good thing. You can see it. You can see when there is no home. You see the longing for it, and you can see that the way in which it's maybe a healthy and a good thing to long for. And yet, many of us also have experienced times when we felt choked and stifled and unchallenged, maybe restless. There may be all different kinds of reasons for this. Bored and maybe living a life that's just too safe. We're not challenged. Maybe someone is ill and experiences that. Maybe someone is maybe dysfunctionally bound to their home in some way. I don't know. But we know somehow that to surrender to this way of life, to total apathy and passivity, where we allow life to just happen to us, that's not good either. That's not a healthy way to live either. Because it's really to fall short of some real potential that we have as human beings and as image bearers of God. It's a good thing to get up and to be challenged and to face something new and to do something hard. I had a friend, a good friend, who before he was a Christian was at a place in his life where he'd done a lot of drugs and was just completely, he could foresee himself just sliding into a completely destructive way of life, and he realized, I need to do something very hard. Otherwise, this is just where I'm going. And he didn't have any notion of following Christ yet at all, but he immediately signed up for AmeriCorps and did something very hard for a couple of years, which he viewed as really a redemptive thing for him. I remember a couple of years ago, I haven't actually seen the new documentary about Julia Child, the amazing American woman who wrote the book The Art of French Cooking, but she was a big TV personality for many years, cooking shows. And I heard an interview from her years ago when she was in Paris because her husband was in the Foreign Service, and she was just completely bored out of her mind. A very, very active, intelligent, vivacious person, but just completely bored out of her mind. Didn't know what to do. What should I throw my energies into? And she talks about getting into French cooking and the rigors of that as being one of the things that really kept her from, she says, playing a lot of golf and becoming an alcoholic. And yeah, it's good to be challenged. It's good to set out and try to tackle difficult things. So we can see that to set out, to take risks, to accomplish something ourselves is also a good thing, as well as the coming home and the having a home and having a sense of security. So again, both of these seem to be in conflict with each other, but they somehow can't be mutually exclusive. We want to have our cake and eat it too, as the expression goes. We want to be able to experience both. Somehow find the fulfillment of our longings for both adventure and home, which is what G.K. Chesterton uses this image of the explorer who thinks he's discovering a new and uncharted land, but actually has just come home. And there's that moment where he sort of experiences both at the same time, the excitement, the adventure, and also the relief and the homecoming. Like, that's the moment where the man is most to be envied, says G.K. Chesterton. So I'm moving along to my second heading here, longings lost and misdirected. So these two longings, I think, are very, very deep and basic to being a human being. As we can see, they manifest themselves in many practical ways, I think. But that does not mean that they're always being pursued in straightforward or godly ways in the world, obviously. Most people, even good Christian folks, are a confused bundle of longings in some way or other. there are many, many ways in which we see these two deep desires functioning in misdirected ways, towards objects that might appear to promise fulfillment but do not. This is getting at a lot of the things that Dick was talking about earlier this morning, about false gods and finding our identity in things that are not God. And one of the ways that these two desires are misdirected is that they can be radically out of proportion. Chesterton describes both of these longings as good and as mutually coexisting in this person at the same time, without negating each other. And yet we see in many people, sometimes in ourselves, a tendency to favor one heavily over the other. There's one way of thinking about this. It's a little bit of a joke, but I'm just going to continually forget to advance my slides. For those of you, I'm sorry if this offends you all. So they're both good things. Yep. And this. Okay, good. So these two sort of archetypal stereotypes of being a thrill seeker or a homebody, or someone who's claustrophobic, can't stand to be penned in, versus someone who's agoraphobic, can't stand to be outside in big places. And again, I'm just putting this in the most extreme possible light just to illustrate what I'm talking about here. Some people I know have a really hard time settling down. They have to move on from one novel experience to the next, or they're restless. And as a result, they have a hard time developing close relationships, have a really hard time finding long-lasting community. Even if they long for it in some way, the longing to keep moving and to experience something new and something more exciting and stimulating, that outweighs the longing for connection. And so settling down and finding a home feels more stifling than comforting. I am a reluctant appreciator of the Enneagram. If anybody else, you know, there's lots of wisdom to be had there, but, you know, many people would identify these as a number 7 on the Enneagram, someone that's just an enthusiast, on to the next thing, you know, at the expense of all the good things that come with connection and patience. And but then there's some people who never want to set out at all. They're so attached to home, to comfort, to security, that they never step out. So this is the archetypal picture here of the agoraphobic. They may be intimidated by the world outside, the people, the dangers, the risk, the potential of difficult commitments, the potential of overcommitting to people, or the potential of failure. Anxiety plays a huge role in this. I'd rather stay in the dysfunctional place I am because I know it, than to set out and try to find something different, which is unknown. And so these are just again extreme sort of polar opposite ends of a spectrum, and we can see different people whose temperaments tend to lead them towards one pole or the other. Sometimes almost in pathological ways. But again, we see somehow, some way, the desire for adventure and the desire to be home should coexist somehow, because when they're severely out of balance, it doesn't go well for people. this is not lives well lived necessarily. And I think one just brief tangent here that I think is important to mention, although I'm not going to dwell on it, is that very often, particularly in Christian circles, these two seemingly polar opposite desires are spoken of in a way that corresponds to the sexes. So a lot of thinking about gender roles has these kind of two tendencies in mind. I don't know if anyone still read if anyone reads the book Wild at Heart still. It's been a long time since I looked at it. But the sort of assumption in that book is that all men intrinsically have this desire to set out and experience adventure and challenge, to kill the beast, whatever it is. And women have the desire intrinsically to be captivating to a man and to be found and to be rescued and to and so there's a way in which these two polar opposite aspects that I'm saying are intrinsic to being a human being are assigned to the sexes. And I think that's a mistake. Again, I'm not going to go into the details here, but I think that we're talking about something that's deeply human. And that everybody to some degree has in them, some to a lesser degree than others, and that's fine, but we can't just Well, I think it's denying of full humanity of people to sort of to push them into one or these other categories based on their sex. I certainly experience both of these to some degree. What are other ways in which these desires can be misdirected? And sometimes by just being directed towards the wrong object. The desire may be a good thing that it's in us, but we turn towards the wrong object. And I wonder whether there's something of the restlessness, the desire for novelty and exploration and excitement that's the seed of marital infidelity, right? Just the association of being faithful to your spouse with being bored, pretty much. You know, is that what being faithful in marriage means? Is just being okay with the same, and wondering what it would be like to have a relationship with somebody else. So that's obviously, I think, an area in which the something that could have been a good desire directed towards the right thing is attached to the wrong thing and becomes extremely destructive. I wonder also, you've already learned about me that I am not technically anything. but, you know, so I've never actually put on a virtual reality headset, and it doesn't appeal to me at all. So just for those of you who are into that, that's, you know, that's cool. But I think a number of years ago when the first really good virtual reality headsets were coming out, and it was spoken of as like the new platform for everything we're going to be doing, and almost messianic language connected to this. Really interesting, even Mark Zuckerberg talking about it as if it was like the second coming. Something about this is really interesting to me, the obsession with virtual reality, because in a sense, it is trying to combine strangeness and total security. You know, it enables you to have the sensation of doing all kinds of things which you would never do, literally from your couch. It's sort of the experience of, or the sensation of strangeness and adventure without any actual risk to your body. Regardless of what it is, whether you're shooting zombies in some, you know, in some fighter game, or whether you're flying over the Grand Canyon, or whatever it is, not necessarily bad things in themselves, but certainly trying to offer a fulfillment of both desires, and maybe that's part of the root of the enthusiasm with which so many people latch onto this. It's a terrible YouTube video of a guy, he's a Christian comedian who's talking about virtual reality church, where he could lie on his bed with his virtual reality goggles on and just select how tight the jeans are of the worship director, and like, it's just so, it's, isn't this great, you know, anyway. Because going to church is a really risky thing. Anyway, but can this even no matter how good the technology gets, can it really be a substitute for the authentic longing of real newness and real safety? No, I don't think. So, but again, this is nothing terribly new. The internet has allowed people to do this for a long time. Basically, say and express things that they would never say and express to a real person's face. Right, there's a moral distance that can come with the way we communicate on the internet. Almost experience the thrill of a good middle school fight in the hallway, but without actually getting punched. Saying things that would get me punched if I was actually in a room with a real person. Right. So, what does it mean that these longings could potentially be redirected or found? To what extent? Is there a good object for these two longings? It could be a source of hope for us. I think the question really is: there a true object towards which we can direct these longings, and can we actually expect the fulfillment of both of them, or is that just a pipe dream? Like I was mentioning before, is it just an unrealistic thing? Or is the only solution to be found in a life of sort of vacillating from one to the next? And there's a lot of wisdom in this, actually, practically speaking. Because, you know, we see this desire, or this need, both of these needs in us. Well, there's appropriate times in life to set out and to face new challenges. There's appropriate times in life to settle down. Right? This is not it's not an either or. In fact, the life of the church, in some way, on a weekly basis, is built on this sort of rhythm. I think, you know, the people of God gathering together to be reminded of reality, to be trained in reality, and then sent out throughout the week to be ministers of the gospel. And the church, I think, can and should function in this way. At least that's one of its functions. And so this sort of coming together to a place, in a sense, of security where we're with people who are calling on the same Lord. And then the setting out is an important rhythm, I think, for Christian people. But ultimately, I'm not talking about just, designing a well-balanced life for yourself. I'm talking about the ultimate fulfillment of these longings. Do they correspond to anything real or not? So I think that the Bible has a lot of promises in it, but I think these two desires are actually met in knowing the one living God. There actually is one object, if you want to call God an object. He's not just an object, but in terms of an object of our desire, that in the deepest sense satisfies both our longings to be astonished and to be welcomed home. And the Lord is only this, can only be this, because he's an infinite person. This is one of the things that Francis Schaeffer emphasized over and over again in his teaching. And he didn't make it up. It's a very biblical idea. But the God of the Bible is both a person, personal. He's not a human person, but he's a person from which our personhood is derived. He's the ultimate person. But he's also infinite, an infinite person. So he's not like the people that we know. These two concepts don't really come together in anywhere except in the God of the Bible. We can imagine some concept of infinity, maybe some mathematical expression of infinity, but it's abstract and completely impersonal. Even when we try to think of the concept of infinity, it's not, you know, it's hard to put flesh on that. Impossible, actually, for us. Or we can imagine a person who is very limited and finite, but personal. We can relate to them as a person, right? They can know us and we can know them. But only God is both. So his infinity, he's the one who has always existed. There's lots of aspects or different ways of talking about this, but the Lord who has always existed, who has made the universe, who has invented time, invented space, is not absent from time or space, but also is in no way contained by time or space. And yet knows us and can speak to us and calls himself our friend and our helper, and is with us in this room and in his church by his Spirit, even indwelling us. So another way of referring to this, sort of the infinity of God and the personalness of God, is just his transcendence and his immanence. And these are more theological terms, but we talk about them all the time at Libri, just because they're so crucial to having an accurate view of who God is biblically. The transcendent just means he is in a sense above, beyond, outside of the world that he has made. Not outside of as an absence, but again uncontained by. Impossible to contain. And imminent, right here, right with you, aware of what's in each of our hearts, intimately acquainted with our stories, better than we are, knows us better than we know ourselves, is concerned for our sick kid, is concerned for our unfulfilling job, whatever it is. Psalm 8 is a wonderful sort of reveling in this. I forget whether I actually have Psalm 8. Yes, good. All right. I'm sorry if that's a little small, but I'll just read the whole thing. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. Through the praises of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings, that you care for them. You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds, and the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky, the fish in the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. Lord, O Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And so you can see, this is, I believe, a Psalm of David, but he's reveling in these two aspects of who God is. And if he was to let go of one and only hold on to the other, his view of God would be really distorted. He's struck by the majesty of God, that as we look at the starry sky, he didn't have anywhere near the kind of concept of the scale of what he was looking at that we do today, or some of us do today. I don't really have an idea of the scale when I look at the stars, but he knows he's looking at something really, really big. Right? He knows that. And he also knows that God just made it. God made those things. So God is in every sense greater than the biggest things we can look at in creation. And yet, he holds on to that reality, which is absolutely true, and then he marvels at the fact that God takes any notice of him at all. How is it that if you are great and powerful and creative and genius enough to create the whole world and the stars, how is it that that God would notice me? How is it that God would have any regard at all for me, let alone what he says here, actually honor human beings in creation? There's a lot of language that echoes Genesis 1 here about the role of human beings in creation as standing over the rest of the creation in a role of stewardship. So these are, you know, David, think of what this psalm would be if you took away one or the other, the transcendence of God or the intimate love and knowledge of God of you. You know, it wouldn't be Psalm 8. And it wouldn't be anything like a full picture of who the Lord is. So another aspect of this, I think, and again, this is just to reiterate, you know, when we talk about human longings, it's such a confusing and thorny topic that leads us in all kinds of directions that are difficult. But the overarching question is, in what sense do our longings that we witness in ourselves indicate something about who we are, who made us, and why? Are they just random and troublesome, or are they actually directing us towards something real? And I think one of the main points I want to make is that we were made to both resemble God, but also to be in a relationship of friendship with God, to resemble him and to be friends with him. And these are very connected, obviously. To be made to resemble God, Dick talked about it this morning. I don't want to go into a lot of depth, but the image of God, the Imago Dei, this fact that every person, despite our sin and brokenness, is still an image bearer of God. And one of the things that I'll be talking about in a later workshop, there'll be a little bit of overlap, is this idea of dominion. You know, what does it mean that human beings have dominion, which is agency, or I call it dominion, power rightly exercised, power rightly used. That's a very crucial aspect of the image of God. At creation, people are given a real authority over the rest of creation. We're God's representatives in the world, placed in the garden to subdue, work with, refine, tend, and care for it. And so this means that the choices that we make actually matter and have an effect in the world around us. That's what dominion is to be able to choose to do something and have it actually make a difference we're not completely impotent in the world. We actually have the capacity to change things around us in amazing ways on purpose, not just by accident. We can think about it and then do it. This is how we were made, and yet because of the fall, we see dominion corrupted all over the place, and that's the main theme of my other workshop, if you want to talk about all the ways in which dominion has been twisted and made into a destructive thing. You can come to that one. But God is the master over creation, and we were made to have mastery, not to be master in an ultimate sense, but to have a level of mastery over the world that we live in. So all this is to say, so this is talking about the one that made us and how we were made. But if you think about this in connection with the longing for newness and exploration and astonishment and adventure, in a sense, it's the call of our own dominion. It's our own dominion, which is a crucial aspect of what it is to be a human being, that's beckoning us. You are capable of doing something new. You can head out and take a risk and not be destroyed. That, you know, there's caveats, you know, some risks, you know, whatever. It's a desire that I think each of us have, but it may be deeply buried or misdirected, but to fulfill a creational purpose of dominion. And when dominion is taken away from somebody, whether it's because of illness, or whether it's because somebody else is dominating them, or whatever it is, human beings do not thrive when dominion is taken away. This is, in a sense, a human being becomes like a ticking time bomb when dominion is taken away from them, because it's such a crucial aspect of what it is to be a human being and to express our humanity. One of the other aspects of the image of God is that we were made to relate to him personally. We weren't just made to have dominion, but we were made to relate to him as people. This is one of the reasons why we are persons, so that we can relate to God as persons in a way that the rest of creation cannot. I think while it's appropriate that we exercise our dominion when relating to the rest of creation, we relate very differently to God. And Schaefer talked about there's two different sort of chasms, if you think about what a human being is in creation. There's one chasm that divides creatures from God. And in that sense, we're standing on the side of the chasm with the rest of creation. There's really not a whole lot of distinction between us and the animals and the trees and the rocks in terms of our dependence on God and the fact that we didn't make ourselves. In that sense, we have everything in common with the created order around us, looking across a chasm to the Lord who is God and who did make us and on whom we're all dependent. The birds and everything. Existence is sustained by him in every moment. So in that sense, in terms of dependence, there's no distinction between me and a goldfish in terms of our dependence on the Lord. But then there's a different chasm, which is the other aspect of what a human being is, which is personhood. And in that sense, we're standing on the side of a chasm with God, looking as persons, being able to relate to and connect with God, looking to the rest of creation that does not have that same relationship with the Lord. So those are two just very crucial aspects of how the Lord made us. And part of this relationship that's personal with God should be trust. This is the basis of what the human relationship with God should be and was before the fall. It's a relationship of complete trust in him. And so this is another aspect of what we are made for. We are made to trust the Lord, to know him and to put our faith in his goodness and his character, to view him and him alone as our provider, our refuge, our strength, our shepherd, our fortress, our wonderful counselor. Think of all the ways that the Bible encourages us to think about God that have to do with trust. Our strong fortress, our rock, our shepherd, a very real help in time of need. All of these are encouraging us to view God as completely trustworthy. We need God, in the words of Psalm 23, to make us lie down in green pastures and lead us beside still waters. And this is an aspect of our dependence on him, but also of our trusting him, our knowing him and knowing his character. I had a professor in grad school who talked about leading sheep by still waters as a very, it's not just a nice poetic image, it's a very practical thing that a shepherd has to do, because sheep tend to drown in fast-moving water. If you live in the mountains and you're trying to herd sheep and you take them to some rapids, it doesn't go well for the sheep. So it's a very, it's a quite a visceral image, actually. You need to find water that's still. So in a fallen world that is at times completely inhospitable to our existence, the Bible encourages us to view God himself as our home. You know, he is our home. Even now, he is our home. It's in him, in Christ, that we have rest. Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary. And so the longing to come home, to be known, to feel safe and secure and at ease, just as the longing to set out and experience something new is the call of our dominion on us, that aspect of who we are, the longing to be at home is the calling of our dependence. It's an equally important aspect of what a human being is, but it's calling to us, beckoning us, this desire we have to simply accept that we have a loving Father, to finally give up running away and trying to build shelters of our own. If I had time, I'd read The Runaway Bunny right now, because it's a wonderful picture of what it is to just, okay, fine. My mother loves me. Fine. I don't have to keep running away. So we were built for both agency and trust, both dominion and dependence. And I think these things are because this is how we're made, we see these desires manifesting themselves in us all the time. And that, I hope, as we talk to friends and people or family members maybe that don't know God or are just disconnected from him, having conversation about these two desires can be really fruitful, I think. But what about friendship with God? I think we see the ultimate fulfillment of these two great longings as we grow in our capacity for friendship with God. Remember, the Lord is both infinite and personal, transcendent and imminent. So it's in this relational sense of relating to that God, the personal and the infinite God, that both these longings are met in the Christian faith. And this is one of the main points of Chesterton in the book Orthodoxy. He's trying to say, actually, as we come to the God of the Bible and submit to the teachings of the Christian faith, we find actually a coming together of these two desires, and the ultimate, the only ultimate fulfillment of them. How can this be? Well, God is the one who actually is capable of inspiring awe and wonder in us, but also welcomes us to be his close friends. So we're meant to both fear him and be at home in his presence. The fact that he is endless and without rival inspires awe, or should inspire awe in us. You can't imagine a more jarring experience of otherness than meeting God. If you think of in Isaiah 6, when the prophet Isaiah goes into the temple and he has a vision of the Lord in the temple, and my dad has often said that what you see is not an experience of cosmic unity. You don't see sort of a Buddhist response to this spiritual experience of seeing God. You see, rather, an extremely jarring experience of disunity, in a sense, of I am not God. God is not me, and there is a moral problem that I have, my sin and the sin of my people, that is a barrier between me and God. And when Isaiah sees the Lord in the temple, he doesn't think that he'll survive the experience. And so there's no, I mean, and this is in a sense really what the presence of God would be for us, if not for Jesus Christ. But you cannot imagine a more intense experience of otherness. Isaiah was not communing with himself in the temple. He was struck by the vast difference between who God is, both morally and existentially, ontologically, God's identity. So as we seek God, as we come to know Him, we're coming to know someone who's ultimately unfathomable. There's no encouragement in the Bible that says one day we'll finally understand exactly who God is in every sense. No, we're encouraged to know Him and know Him truly, but we never come to the bottom of who God is. So I keep quoting random anecdotes about Francis Schaeffer. It's not because I feel like I have to. It's just, but yeah, he says he expects to go on learning for all eternity because he's in the presence of the Lord. Right? This is a very quite a vibrant and beautiful picture of what being in the presence of God is. It's not static. But because it's the Lord whose presence we're in, it's ever developing. Yeah, so I think there's, and we can see this in the Bible again and again. To come to know God truly is not to be bored or stifled or hemmed in. If that's what we associate with knowledge of God and knowing God personally, then we have misconceptions about who God is. There's something wrong. He's an endless source of life and vitality, and knowledge and wisdom. And like I said, when you read the Bible, nobody who has any sort of even very mitigated experience of God responds with a yawn or eh. No, that's never what's described for us in the Bible. But there's also the fact that He is our self, our home, and our security, and the many, many amazing images of the Bible to communicate God's paternal love and connection to His children. Or even maternal. I mean, like a hen gathering its chicks together under his wing. There's this incredibly intimate and comforting picture of God's care for us. So He is the answer to our desire to come home. To know Him is to come home. And only because He's completely trustworthy. So, we're made for this kind of awe and this kind of intimacy, and it's only in God that we find both of them in the same place. Remember, it's only God who is both infinite and personal, but it's only in God, because of that, that this deep longing for newness and adventure can meet our longing for home. So there's sort of a huge and weighty paradox here, and I think these two desires come together and meet in the person of Jesus Christ. I mean, Jesus Christ Himself, the man who is God, fully man and fully God. Jesus Himself is a deep mystery. The incarnation is described as the central mystery of the Christian faith. How this could be. We're not encouraged to have delusions that we can somehow explain it all rationally in a way that makes sense to us, how the Lord of the universe could become a child without ceasing to become the Lord of the universe. There's something unfathomable and yet deeply relatable about Jesus Himself, and you see the responses of His disciples just highlighting that. I think in Matthew 8, does anyone ever read the Jesus Storybook Bible? It's a classic, you know. It's the Bible, so it's really nice, interesting ways of retelling some of the biblical stories. But she does a really good job in Matthew 8 in the passage where Jesus stills the storm. He's in the boat with His disciples, and 1 minute Jesus, who was their friend, their rabbi, the one that they love and know intimately, he's asleep in the back of the boat because he's very tired. He's been preaching all day by the side of the lake. He's exhausted, just like you or I would be exhausted if we were preaching all day. And His disciples, you know, you imagine them sort of covering up with a blanket or something like that and letting Him sleep. The next minute, He wakes up and He talks to the weather, and the weather does what He says. And the Jesus Storybook Bible has a nice phrase. It says that, you know, the waves and the wind recognized His voice, because it was the voice that made them. And it's not what the Gospel of Matthew says specifically, but it's completely what it implies. So she took, I think, a nice liberty there. But anyway, so yeah. So what do you do with that if you're in a very small boat with that person? I think that the disciples are shaken to their core because they know this is the Jesus they know and love intimately, and he's their friend, and they've shared, probably a couple hundred meals with him and walked all over Palestine with him, and yet he just spoke to the weather, and the weather is clearly his servant. You see this also, this jarring kind of, not jarring, but just deeply paradoxical thing coming together in Jesus' death. It's both Jesus, the man who was kind and wise, their friend, their rabbi, their traveling companion, unjustly tried by a corrupt court, being publicly shamed in his death. But also, that's just on the surface what they're witnessing, right? But also, it's God himself taking on the full weight of humanity's sin. You have these very close and intimate and relatable aspects of who Jesus is, and then you have the theological reality of who he is at the same time in everything he does. He doesn't like put on his human hat and say some things and his God hat and say other things. He's God and man in everything he does and says, glued together in every way. So you can almost think of Jesus Christ is God's transcendence and immanence embodied together. So, to know Jesus is in a sense to be astonished and be at home at the same time. And that's, in a sense, the incarnation is bringing those two realities together. So, really what I've been aiming at here is, without using the word, is an apologetics of longing. Like when we think about our own longings, but also just notice the longings that are in the people around us, the people we know, whether they're directed in true and good ways or whether they're completely misdirected and creating havoc, the longings themselves have an origin. And I want to say that all of these things that we see are an indication, first, that we were made, but it's also an indication what we were made for. I think one of the most fruitful things we can do with our friends who are not Christians is to encourage them to think about their own longings. Why is it that you have that? Why is it that that is such a deep desire in you? Where does it come from? What do you expect to do with it? Are they meant to lead us towards anything that's objectively real or not? Are they just basically, sometimes I think you look around and you think, man, all the longings that human beings have, they're just a radical inconvenience. They just cause us to always be unhappy, no matter what we're doing. We're never quite content because we have this almost inbuilt discontent in us, don't we? Which is connected to our longings for something different, something more, something that reaches beyond the mundane or the frustrating aspects of everyday life. And for many people today, for many contemporary people, figuring out what your deepest desire is and then just pursuing that, that's the point of life. It's happiness. It's to be fulfilled. And how else would you find happiness except just sort of figure out what your thing is and then just go for it and don't let anybody tell you different. And don't let anybody interrupt your dreams for your future and just pursue it, whatever it is. But there's no real guidance as to what it should be. Just whatever you decide is your dream, that's what you should go for. And this obviously ties in with identity very closely. This can sound great, right? Lots of people believe it. It's reinforced by ads and movies and everything. But there's just an enormous number of people running after their heart's desire who've made personal happiness their priority and are completely dissatisfied and restless and unsure of who they even are. Disillusioned and empty. So this is, rather than viewing this as a frustrating, look at the modern world, the state it's come to, this is really an opportunity to talk to people and to get them to examine their own misplaced desires. And some of the people that are most unhappy in the world are the people whose dreams have basically come true. Think of the desire to sort of be at the top of your field and to make the most money and all the, how many of those people are actually content? There's really, statistically speaking, a lot of studies admit there's no actual connection between contentment and wealth at all. In fact, it seems to look just the opposite. So the question is, was there anything in these longings at all, or are they just a total sham? Is there anything, by that I mean, is there a true object to which they could be directed? An object that won't disappoint you and destroy you? Is the longing to explore and set out just self-indulgent and arrogant and something that only rich people could consider and just entitlement? The longing to experience adventure, is that just self-indulgence? Or is there a real object that would fulfill that desire? Is the longing to come home just weakness, overdependence, reverting to childish, childish needs for security and assurance? Is it just wish fulfillment because we feel that if we were really to look closely, we'd realize we're homeless in the universe? There's no real home for a human being. Or are these two desires true to reality? That's the question, I think, that's really potentially fruitful to ask, even ourselves, but also the people we know. I'm just going to end with a strange illustration. I'm going to go through the slides that I skipped. Okay, yeah, all right. Anybody like to fish? Any fish? Any anglers? If you're in a boat fishing, suddenly you feel this massive tug on your line, and you know there's a big fish, right? This is the moment, we all live for, right? You fight the fish, you slowly reel it in. Maybe if you have, if you're a fly fisherman, you may have your drag, you may pull out line, if that sound is, what we live for too. Your rod bends way down like this guy's. You know there's a fish there. You fight it slowly. You can't see it, but you can feel how big it is. And as it gets closer and closer, you can see the surface of the water churn. Some people call it the boil on the water. You see the water get stirred up. You still can't see the fish, but you can see that it's real because of how it's affecting its environment around us. Now, what if that was all there was to fishing? What if you were fishing and you feel the tug, you feel your line go out, you see the water boil, and then you cut your line and go home? What if that was the whole point of it? There's nothing more to it than that. Well, it's hard to imagine why any of us would want to go fishing. Because, of course, the only reason why the tug and the boil are so exciting is because there's a real living creature under the surface. It's a real thing. It's outside of myself. And it's doing the tugging, and it's doing the churning. The excitement of fighting a big fish, for most people, I think, is the anticipation of seeing and having it in hand, regardless of whether you're keeping it or throwing it back. It's having it in your hand. Of finally having a good close look at that thing, undeniably, shockingly real. Maybe very heavy, maybe tough, maybe covered in teeth and spines. Always unhappy to see you. I have a good friend who was involved in a tuna fishing sort of competition off of Massachusetts, out far, far, far off the coast all day long. One of the guys hooked a massive fish, fought it for 6 hours, to realize that it was an 8-foot-long great white shark. And the guy who, the guy, the captain of the boat, could tell it wasn't a tuna by how it was behaving. But still, it's like, oh, that's reality, right? Fighting for 6 hours and not ever seeing the thing, it's not really where it's at. And most of us know how intensely disappointing it is to have a big fish on and have the line break before we even get a look at it, right? So much of the pursuit of happiness, okay, this is where I'm going with this analogy. So much of the pursuit of happiness in the people we see today is trying to be satisfied with the splashes and the tug and the boil on the surface of the water, trying to tell ourselves that this is all there is and we should be content with it. This is good enough, right? And these kinds of experiences might be exciting, but they're only ultimately indications of something much deeper and more fundamental that we are longing for without naming it. So the proper and satisfying object of all of our deepest desires. So this is another picture. You can't quite see the fish. We see its effects, like the effects of a fish on the surface of the water, but we don't have it in hand. So fishing for me is all about, and I think for most people, it's all about that point of connection between me and this otherworldly creature that I never get to see. And the big strike when you get a big fish on the line, it's only exciting because it means that. It means that there's something real there. And this is what we were made for. Is this and so there's all kinds of different directions we could go in this conversation. There's all kinds of, one of the main explanations of human desires that we'll find today is sort of in the combination of neuroscience and evolutionary biology. And as the two come together, they can sort of claim to explain absolutely everything. Well, clearly we have these desires and longings that don't seem to have any object right now, but they serve some purpose early in human history. And therefore, the desires we experience are just sort of residual in our brains, but don't actually correspond to anything real that matters now. I mean, this is just a complete standard response or explanation for things like this. But very, very few people can actually want to admit that that's all our desires are when it comes to practically living. I want to, I know I've been going on for a long time, to wrap up just in another minute here. Actually, you know what? Let's just wrap up now. I think we can stop now. The rest of this is just pointless. I'll just, yeah. But another good read, a similar argument to what I'm trying to make and very much inspired by it is C.S. Lewis talking about these kinds of things, the desire, or the reality that our desires indicate, and the weight of glory, that famous sermon that he preached that's been really helpful to read. He says that, you know, if you're dying of hunger on a raft in the Atlantic Ocean, your desire for food doesn't indicate that you're going to get it. You may starve and die, but it does indicate that food is a real thing and that human beings survive by eating food. In the same way, the phenomenon he called the phenomenon of falling in love would be a very strange thing in a sexless world. I mean, you may not actually, the person you love may not reciprocate it in any way. You may be brokenhearted, but still, it indicates something. The desire indicates something real.